Do you see the deals on these brands?
Of course you can't. This is a podcast.
But when you go to Ross this spring, you'll see brands you know at prices you love. We're talking all the shoes, hues, and oohs at 20 to 60% off department store prices. Go see the savings at Ross.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
For 9 years, a man terrorized women across the D.C. region.
The more the victims resisted, the more violent he became.
Breaking into homes and raping his victims before killing a brilliant young scientist in 1998. Then he suddenly stops, leaving police with a lot of clues and one unknown subject.
I'm Paul Wagner. Join me for Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 288 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what is going on with you?
Hey, man, I'm doing okay. How about you?
I'm doing great.
Yeah.
100% better than I was doing last week.
That's a good thing.
Not sick anymore. The voice is better.
Yeah.
So, yeah, feeling good.
Feeling good.
Let's go ahead and give our Patreon shout outs. We had Tracy Bauer.
What's going on, Tracy?
Liz Arnheim.
Hey, Liz.
Sam Hagler.
What's up, Hagler?
Sherry Andrews Sarton.
Hey, Sarton.
Ashley LeBlanc.
Hey, there's Ashley.
Kim Panetti.
Well, thank you, Kim.
Moogly Games.
I love me some games.
Courtney Shares.
Hey, Shares.
Brandon Wilkinson.
What's up, Brandon?
Paige Nicole.
Hey, Paige.
Ethan Merceth.
Well, thank you, Ethan.
Debbie Graves.
Hi, Debbie.
Stephanie Drocker.
Oh, that's awesome, Stephanie.
Katie Cooper.
Hey, Cooper.
Beth Erlinson.
I like that name, Erlinson.
Natalie Buenos.
Oh, Buenos.
Rebecca Gardner.
Hey, Rebecca.
Paul Worley.
What's up, Paul?
The G-Man.
Hey, there's the G-Man.
Carl Greenblatt.
Appreciate that, Greenblatt.
And last but not least, Deanna Lori Stock.
Well, hey, thanks, Lori Stock.
And then we go back into the vault. This week, we selected Trisha Rathke.
Oh, awesome, Trisha.
Yeah, we appreciate the new support, the continued support. We also had great PayPal donations from Leah Miller.
Thanks, Leah.
And Jocelyn Sinclair.
Awesome, Jocelyn.
So thank you to everyone. Gibbs, we have so much out right now. We put out a Patreon episode on Saturday.
You've been busy.
On Charles Rodman Campbell. This is an absolute monster. He sexually assaulted a woman, went to prison, got out early, and then went back and killed her.
Yeah.
As well as her daughter and the woman's neighbor
who disturbing.
Yeah, who testified against him. So if you're a Patreon member, definitely check that out. And then right now on TCAT, we have an episode out about a rapper named Antron Singleton, who went by the name Big Lurch.
Yeah.
Who, while high on PCP, murdered a woman and ate some of her.
Yeah, see, me as a rapper, I never did anything like that.
No, it is a very, very bizarre episode, what this guy did and, you know, how his defense team tried to spin it and all of that. All right, buddy, are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
I'm ready.
We are talking about the Lava Lake murders, and we're headed back to 1924. It was in April of that year that three fur trappers from Bend, Oregon were found floating in the recently thawed Big Lava Lake. The men were attacked and fatally shot. One suspect was arrested but never convicted of the three murders. The Lava Lake murders remain one of Oregon's oldest unsolved cases.
So we're headed out west.
To a place that you lovingly call Oregon.
I do.
Lovingly, but incorrectly.
Yes. I've been told by many.
By many. And you will continue to be told because you continue to say it that way. So these three trappers were 50-year-old Ed Nichols, 35-year-old Roy Wilson, and 25-year-old Dewey Morris. In 1923, they decided to trap together that winter. They stayed in a log cabin near Little Lava Lake, owned by a man named Ed Logan. Logan was a logging contractor in Bend, Oregon. He allowed Nichols, Wilson, and Morris to use his cabin in exchange for taking care of his foxes. The trappers got everything set up in the fall of 1923 before the snow started.
I have to tell you about Bend. It's supposed to be a beautiful place. I remember when I was a little bit younger in my career, I met a few people that retired there. And they were telling me how beautiful it was. And I looked it up on, back then, the slow internet, you know?
Yeah.
So 3 hours later, I finally saw a picture and read about it. And
right.
It is absolutely a beautiful place.
I've actually heard that too. I've never been out that way. I'd love to take a trip to the Pacific Northwest, but I never have. Now, I will say, you know, this idea of trapping.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I mentioned it to you a while back. I was watching the whole series of Mountain Men.
Yeah.
And there's a guy on that show who flew to the Alaska bush.
Okay.
And he stayed like in this little cabin. He literally had nothing but a snowmobile, but he stayed out there for a long time. He trapped. And then when trapping season was over, he'd fly his plane back home. And that's how he made his money.
Well,
it was a rough, it looked like a rough life, man.
Some people like that.
He liked it. He liked the solitude. Now, obviously, he liked to get back home to his family, but it almost seemed like when he got back home, he was like, ah, oh, man, I can't wait for trapping season to start again.
Can't wait to get back out to my solitude.
Roy Wilson and Ed Nichols spent Christmas 1923 in Bend, Oregon, but some sources say that it was Dewey Morris and Roy Wilson who came to town. Nichols brought furs with him and said that the trapping in the area was good. This event was important because the men were alive and in good health. Wilson and Nichols said they'd return to town in February. According to the Bend Bulletin, the last person to see the three trappers was a man named Alan Wilcoxon, former owner of the Elk Lake Resort. On January 15, 1924, on his way up to the resort, he spent the evening with the trappers at Ed Logan's cabin. When he came back to Bend, he reported that they were in high spirits and good health. Wilcoxon returned home on a different trail, so he only saw the trappers on his way to the resort. He did not see them on his way back.
But I'm guessing up in that area during that time, it wasn't that unusual.
No, it's also 1924.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not keeping in touch with text messages.
No, we are not.
Can't send an email and say, hey, everything's going well. Just wanted to check in with you.
Right.
By April, people were concerned that no one had heard from the three men. H.D. Ennis, brother-in-law of Roy Wilson, and Dewey's brother, Owen Morris, thought that by this point, something was wrong. Ennis became worried because obviously he hadn't heard from Roy in a while. In early April, Ennis tried to drive to the cabin, but he couldn't because he had car trouble. Ennis and Morris decided to travel to the Little Lava Lake cabin on April 13th, 1924. According to the Bend Bulletin, the search party arrived at the cabin and immediately noticed something was wrong. A weakened cat was found inside. The cat sprang out the door, rushed between one of the men's feet, and headed for the nearby fox pens. The search party thought that this cat must have been there for months, surviving only on the food that it found inside the house. Okay, not starting out good.
No.
You open the door, there is a cat who's obviously not in a great state.
No, not looking good.
That's not looking good. There were pots on the stove with burned food in them. The table was set for a meal, but the dishes hadn't been used. The trapper sled that they used to carry food and equipment was missing, but their clothes, guns, and bedrolls were still inside the cabin, as were their coats, caps, and jackets, along with three rifles, two shotguns, all their large firearms, and a revolver. But a revolver belonging to Ed Logan was missing. It was also said that their snowshoes and axes were still in the cabin. So, you know, we're saying not good. This is also not good. In fact, it's very, very bad. You know, when you think about where they're at,
right?
The temperatures, the men aren't in the cabin.
No.
But what is inside the cabin is not painting a good sign.
This is what they need to survive.
And they don't have it.
No.
The Ben Bulletin also reported that a calendar inside the cabin was still showing the month of January. Okay, you can make something out of that. You cannot. My thought is today, all right, people don't use calendars quite as much.
Yeah.
Like a wall calendar. But back then, you would need it. What other way would you have to kind of mark the days and know what's going on?
That's true. But I will say that there's been times back in the day I had a calendar.
1924?
No, not that far back.
Oh, okay.
But I would like
forget. Just
forget, you know, yeah. Like realize it's been 3 months now since I pulled off those previous months that passed.
Well,
by.
You know what that tells me is you didn't really need the calendar.
I really didn't need it.
Because obviously 3 months have passed and you weren't using it.
Yeah. Oh, that's those are appointments I was supposed to be on. Oh, now I see.
But I think, you know, if we're talking about 1924, family members would see that and they wouldn't look at it as a great sign. They probably wouldn't dismiss it the way that we might now if we walked into someone's home and saw that. So it looked like the men were about to eat when they were lured outside by something or someone. All five of Ed Logan's foxes were missing from their pen. The fox food in the pen was untouched. And I think this was concerning to the people there as well, because these foxes were very valuable. One of the foxes alone was worth $1,000.
You got to remember, this is 1924.
That is a boatload of money.
Yeah.
And another was said to have been worth $600. Ed Logan later reported that if a stranger came to the cabin, the foxes would be so nervous they wouldn't eat, which could explain why their food pans were full. Now, you and I have done a lot of stories. We've talked about people who have killed people for not a lot of money. You could make a case that someone might kill three people to get their hands on foxes worth thousands of dollars in 1924. That is so much money back then.
It really is.
Then Ennis and Morris found a bloodstained hammer in a storage shed. And I think this is what caused them the most concern. They returned to Bend to notify Ed Logan and get some more help to search for the trappers. On April 14th, 1924, the Bend Bulletin reported relatives fear for safety and search party sent. Breakfast, last meal, Dewey Morris, Ed Nichols, and Roy Wilson started trip to Crane Prairie. Theory, ice bridge danger is fear expressed.
Heck of a headline.
It is way too long and somewhat confusing, to be honest with you. Ennis and Ed Logan came back the next day, joined by superintendent of the Tumalo Fish Hatchery, Pearl Lines. They decided to go to Crane Prairie, a few miles from the cabin. It was known that the trappers kept a food cache there. It was initially thought that the three men went to Crane Prairie Dam to get more food. To get to the cache, they would have had to cross part of the Crane Prairie Reservoir, and partial draining of the artificial lake might have left an icy path. Sled tracks indicated that the men might have started this trip. But when they got there, the search party found that none of the food had been touched. So I think that kind of blows that theory out of the water.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
When they returned to the cabin, they found Clarence Adams, a deputy Deschutes County Sheriff, and also game warden. He was there to assist with the search. The search party discovered spent gun cartridge shells in the snow.
So you got to be getting a little bit more concerned, right?
Yeah, depending on how you look at it. You know, you could say, okay, maybe the guys were hunting food and that's where the shells came from. Or you could say someone did them harm and that's where the shells came from. Either way, you're concerned because you can't find them. So to your point, I think you'd be more likely to look at that as a negative, as maybe an ominous sign.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they're not there.
Exactly.
And you don't know where they are. By April 16th, the search party had searched the Crane Prairie Reservoir. There were three cabins along the men's trap line, so they wanted to check all of them. The search party found the trappers' trap lines and found 12 martens and one skunk all frozen. And this is where my knowledge of mountain men comes in.
Oh, yeah, the martens?
Because that was what he was trapping a lot of, were these martens. But the trap line, to me, was interesting. Because he used they would have used a sled. He used a snowmobile,
right?
Obviously.
Yeah.
Technology. But the snowmobile, he just went up and down this trap line, checking these traps, you know, every day to see what was in there. But I think what it does is it gives you a line to follow, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what they're going to be going over day in and day out. So it's a good place to start. But I think when you find all of these animals that normally would have been collected daily and you realize that they've been there for a long time, they're frozen. That's of major concern.
Yeah, it's letting you know that the trap lines haven't been checked in a while, right? So how long have these people been missing?
Deputy Sheriff Adams left on the 16th for supplies and to report back to the sheriff. The next day, the search party found the trapper's missing sled in a snowdrift on the shore of Big Lava Lake, about a quarter mile from Little Lava Lake. This was unusual because they usually kept it propped against the side of the cabin. And there was a stain that appeared to be blood on one of the sled boards. So I hate to keep saying it, but it's like everything that this search party is uncovering is more and more concerning. Because now there's blood.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, is it human blood or is it blood from one of the
animals? Trappings? Yeah. The board was given to Dr. George Vandervoort, a physician, for analysis. On April 18th, he announced the blood on the sled was not human blood. Okay, so now you're not as concerned.
But you're still wondering, how did the sled get out here?
And where are our friends and family members?
Yeah.
Thankfully, the search party were described as expert woodsmen. So they noticed what was called a dim trail leading to the middle of the lake. The search party followed the sled trail about 100 yards from the lakeshore, and they found a depression where someone had cut a hole in the ice earlier that winter. The hole was now frozen over and filled with snow, but they could tell the ice sheet had been altered in some way. One of the search parties found brown hair near the hole. The hair was brought to town on Saturday the 19th.
Well, so they're getting, I want to say, warmer?
Well, they just keep finding things, yeah, one after another, but they're trying to find out what it all means. Okay, now what does this hair mean?
But I can visualize all this, you know, as we're walking through it. I can visualize, you know, this dim trail and them getting out to the middle of the lake and seeing this cutaway that's now filled with snow and what that might lead to.
According to the Bend Bulletin, after finding the hair, there was no doubt in the minds of the men crouched on the ice that somewhere beneath them lay the bodies of their friends. The problem is, final affirmation would have to wait until the ice broke up on the lake.
That'd be rough, you know, to think that most likely your friends or family members are
dead
in the water
underneath however thick sheet of ice.
Yeah.
The next morning, four skinned fox carcasses were found under a tree near the cabin. One of the foxes was shot between the eyes with a .22 rifle. The others were clubbed, and only the most valuable silver gray fox was completely skinned.
I mean, that's the fox that was worth $1,000 back then, which is like near $20,000 today. That's a lot of money.
That is. The Bend Bulletin reported, The men had gotten a sack of fox feed on January 13th from a place where Logan had stored it, and only about enough feed for the foxes for one day had been taken from it, indicating that the men were not at the fox farm much later than January 14th when they were last seen.
So we're getting a timeline put together, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting the way that they are putting it together. And so you have a sack of feed, and someone can tell about how much a day's worth of feed is. They believe that's how much is missing from the sack. So, okay, they were only there for about a day. True Crime All the Time Unsolved is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming. Like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare. So it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at Progressive.com to join the over 27 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Now you can paint with peace of mind. Claire is an innovative new e-commerce paint startup that takes the hassle out of paint shopping with a streamlined selection of designer curated colors, peel and stick paint swatches, and premium paint and supplies delivered straight to your door. Claire was founded by an interior designer named Nicole Gibbons. Nicole saw that the traditional paint shopping experience was outdated and full of hassle. So she decided to create a better brand and a whole new experience. It's easier, faster, more convenient, and more inspiring. Unlike traditional paint brands, which overwhelm you with thousands of colors, Claire focuses on fewer, better colors, expertly curated through an interior designer's lens. They even have what they call the Claire Color Genius, a fun 2-minute quiz that's like having an interior designer help you choose a paint color. And their peel and stick paint swatches are amazing. They're an exact match to the paint color and finish, and you can instantly put them on your walls and see what colors work best in your space. So for your next paint project, definitely give Claire a try. Go to claire.com/TCAT for 10% off your order. That's claire.com/TCAT for 10% off. One of the search party who was traveling to the river for water found a patch of blood on the snow, as well as a front tooth and more hair. Okay. Once you get into the area of body parts,
yeah,
and I'll call teeth that, I would be very alarmed. Blood, a tooth, hair, not good signs.
Something's not adding up.
On the 21st, the search party was still waiting for the ice to break up. And then the bodies of the three trappers were found on April 23rd, 1924. That evening, Ennis and Adams traveled to Big Lava Lake to go fishing. They saw that much of the lake had melted. Ed Logan joined the search party. They found a rowboat that was buried in snow, and they took it out onto the lake. When they got out to where the hole in the ice had once been, they found three bodies floating on the surface. It was Ed Nichols, Roy Wilson, and Dewey Morris. The men were fully dressed and only slightly decomposed. According to a 1961 Bend Bulletin article, the trappers were found fully clad but badly mutilated.
I bet that icy cold water kind of preserved them a little bit.
Yeah, obviously it would slow down decomposition quite a bit. Now, what does badly mutilated mean? And we got to figure that out because they're fully clothed. The search party tied ropes to the men's bodies, dragged them to the shore, and tied them to an ice shelf. And it was then that they discovered that each of them had been shot. And Clarence Adams traveled back to town for reinforcements. So, you know, all this time, they're worried about what's going on with these three guys. They're finding signs. Many of them don't look good.
Right.
Now, obviously, they've discovered the worst possible outcome. All three men are dead, and all three men were shot. So right away, you know, they didn't die of some accident, exposure, nothing like that. These three men were murdered.
And why?
And who?
And who?
So a big group of expert woodsmen gathered together. They traveled to the crime scene. Clarence Adams, Jerome Ward, Ray Ward, Owen Benn, and Don Morris, who were Dewey's brothers, Robert Sawyer, editor of the Benn Bulletin, photographer Myron Simons, coroner C.P. Niswanger, and Paul Hosmer.
Quite the crew.
They keep saying expert woodsmen. My thought is there were a lot more people back then who would be described as expert woodsmen.
That's true.
Than would be today, especially in that area.
Yeah.
You'd almost have to be to stay alive.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, you had no choice, right?
Right. You had to become an expert woodsman to make money, to stay alive, to feed yourself.
You'd be like an expert basement dweller.
I would be.
Yeah.
According to the Deschutes Pioneer, future Deschutes County Sheriff Claude McCauley wrote in his report, even though the weather was perfect, the clear air was impregnated with the odor of death and decomposition, and it was with an undefinable spirit of awe and consternation that the little party of hardy outdoorsmen laid aside their packs, kicked off their snowshoes, and prepared to tackle a grim job which was little to their liking.
I have to say, back then, the writing was pretty good.
Much more fancy,
yes,
than it is today. I mean, you know, you're saying that this was a future sheriff, and this is written as though it would be in a novel.
Yeah. Instead of saying the air smelled like death, the air
was impregnated. Yeah. A different time.
Yeah.
Different time. So all three men had multiple wounds from a shotgun, pistol, and blunt instrument, possibly a hammer. It's estimated that they were killed sometime in January 1924. So makes sense if you think about the calendar still being on the month of January. According to the Headlight Herald, Nichols was shot at close range by a shotgun, which had torn away part of his face and chest. Wilson was shot in the right shoulder and shot with a pistol behind his ear. And someone had gone berserk with a blunt instrument on Morris's face. Morris was shot in the left elbow and had a hole behind his right ear, which appeared to come from a hammer.
Pretty brutal.
Gruesome, brutal. According to the Weekly Source, Claude McCauley wrote about the crime scene. Ed Nichols still had his glasses on, the ones he used for reading. A shotgun fired at close range had carried away the lower part of his right jaw and part of his chest. A watch in his coat pocket had stopped at 10 minutes after 9. Roy Wilson's right shoulder had been almost entirely shot away by a charge of shot, and there was a bullet behind his right ear. Dewey Morris had been wounded in the left elbow by a charge of shot, and a hole a little larger than a silver dollar had been crushed through his skull at the back of his right ear.
So just trying to visualize all this. And
and I think it's easier because of this Claude McCauley guy is so descriptive.
Yeah.
In his writing.
It's just horrifying when I'm thinking about it, you know, just
what is. And you and I have talked about shotguns before. A shotgun at close range, depending on the type of shot that is used, is so devastating. When you hear him describe it as the shot carried away the lower part of his right jaw,
yeah,
and part of his chest, it's so descriptive. It really paints a picture of what this shotgun blast did to him. It was devastating.
Well, it makes sense about them finding some hair, a tooth, right? It's adding up.
Well, it is because of how brutal these injuries were. You know, if you're shot in the face with a shotgun, it takes off some of your jaw. Most likely, you're losing some teeth as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, it seemed like the killer had not worked alone. Deputy Sheriff Clarence Adams believed that two men were responsible for the murders. He believed that one killer lured the men out, and then the other shot them ambush style near the house. The Bend Bulletin wrote in 1924, "This theory is supported by the facts that a single shot caused the death of each of the victims, that each was apparently shot from behind, and that the bodies were in their shirt sleeves," meaning they hadn't put on outerwear, coats, right, which you would do if you had planned to go outside for a long period of time. But if something startled you and you ran outside to check it out, or if somebody cried out and you ran out of the cabin quickly, okay, maybe you don't grab your coat. You don't put anything else on. So I get it. That makes some sense.
Yeah. And I think knowing that they left their coats, their guns, their items that they would need for day-to-day survival, if they were going to be away from the cabin for any length of time, they would have taken that stuff with them.
So everyone working at the crime scene started theorizing about who the killer or killers could be. In 1961, the Bend Bulletin reported, "In order to find the camp in the heavy winter snows, he would have had to have been an expert woodsman." There's that saying again.
Sure.
"And also would have been well acquainted with the region. It was also reported that the investigators suspected the motive was revenge. One potential suspect was a recluse who lived at nearby Cultus Lake, but Deschutes County Sheriff S.E. Roberts denied that this person was involved."
So yeah, I agree, whoever this suspect was, clearly this had to be an outdoorsman. How else would they have gotten to the cabin with the type of temperature it was outside? It just, I think that's a no-brainer. I think the important part was they had to have some type of knowledge of the region they're in.
Well, and if it was revenge related, then they had to know that these men were there at that specific cabin.
Yeah.
So they had to have that knowledge as well. Ed Logan had a clue that led to a formal suspect. Logan remembered that a year prior, a man named Lee Collins was trapped with Nichols. They got into a heated argument over a wallet. Nichols accused Collins of stealing it. Nichols told Ed Logan that Collins threatened to get him one day.
People argue over wallets. We've argued over my wallet. The fact that I don't open it up ever.
The fact that you don't pay for anything. Yeah. It's never led to me threatening you with bodily harm.
And you never said, "I'm going to get him one day."
Yeah, you can make of that statement what you want. My thought is in 1924, that's a very threatening statement to say, "I'm going to get you one day."
Yeah, I agree with you, because it was something not to take lightly back then.
Today, you could say that and mean, "I'm going to prank you. I'm going to," you know, you could make that into a number of different things. My thought is in 1924, that meant
exactly what it says. I'm going to get you one day.
Lee Collins's real name was actually Charles Kimsey, and Kimsey had a lengthy criminal record. He escaped from the Idaho penitentiary in October of 1915. He was serving 3 to 14 years for larceny. Kimsey was wanted in Oregon for attempted murder, Nevada for murder, Idaho for escape, car theft, forgery, bad checks, burglary, and also attempted murder in Montana.
Sounds like a guy you just don't really want to run into out in the woods.
Or anywhere.
Yeah.
I don't want to run into this guy anywhere. But now, let's put it into context. I'm going to get you one day.
This is a guy that would get you one day then.
Yeah, I think it's even more concrete what that means. The guy's wanted for murder in multiple states.
Sounds like he backs up his talk.
Kimsey was once a government-employed trapper and was considered an expert marksman with a rifle and revolver. Kimsey said that he used several aliases, Lee Collins, and Tom Rose. Bend Bulletin writer Don Bergdorfer described Kimsey as a person so despicable that no crime was beyond him, not even a triple murder.
That talks a lot about someone's character, doesn't it?
In 1923, Kimsey was charged with robbery and attempted murder. He hired a man named W.E. Harrison to drive a rented car to Idaho for him. But on the journey there, Kimsey stopped the car, hit Harrison with a gun, and tied his hands and feet. He overdosed Harrison with poison and threw him into an abandoned dry well. Harrison actually vomited up the poison and managed to escape. Kimsey thought he was dead when he took off in the stolen rental car, but Harrison was able to travel to a nearby ranch and get help. You know, we've done some other cases that went back a ways where we've talked about rental cars. I just really had no idea that there would have been rental cars in the 1920s.
I wonder how that all worked.
I don't know. How they even keep track of you.
Yeah.
You just go get the car and never come back.
We're going to send a telegraph to the other place you're supposed to drop the car off. So
please show up there.
Yeah. Now they won't get the telegraph until you actually drop the car off, and it'll be weeks later when they know that you were supposed to drop it off.
Obviously, this was a bad guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's go back to this situation. You poison a man and you throw him into a well. Okay. You assume he's dead.
Yeah.
You leave, but he's not dead. He vomits up the poison. He manages to get out of the well and he escapes to a nearby ranch.
It was a lucky day for him.
So going back to the three trappers, they were murdered, it's believed, around January 15th. On January 22nd, 1924, a man who looked very similar to Charles Kimsey took fox pelts to Portland to sell them at a local fur company.
That's pretty suspicious.
Well, I would say it's very suspicious if the man was actually Charles Kimsey. You know, we talked about these foxes, how much some of them were worth, and the fact that I think there would be many people, unfortunately, who would murder multiple people to get their hands on something worth that amount of money.
Yeah.
In 1924.
Yeah. It was a lot of money for that time.
W.C. Bender, a traffic officer from Portland, looked at a picture of Charles Kimsey and said that on January 22nd, a similar looking man approached him while he was directing traffic at an intersection downtown. He was carrying a gunny sack and asked where he could find a reliable fur dealer. The officer directed him to the Schumacher Fur Company.
I'm always amazed that people can remember what happened on certain dates. I'm glad that this guy does, but I'm just saying I'd have a hard time recounting what I did 2 days ago.
Yeah, it always amazes me as well. My memory is not good at all. Now, if you are a police officer, having a good memory, I think, is paramount to doing your job.
That's true.
According to the Bend Bulletin, a man who looked like Charles Kimsey sold his furs with Schumacher for $110 cash. He showed Schumacher a license in the name of Ed Nichols, one of the murder victims. Schumacher employees said that the man said he'd been trapping in the Packsaddle Mountain area. But later examination of the furs revealed that they were removed by a person who knew very little about skinning animals or who had been in a great hurry.
Maybe that's why he only got $110 for him.
Yeah. The other thing that I learned from that show, Mountain Men, you know, obviously skinning animals is kind of an art. And if you want to get the most money for your furs, you have to be very precise in how you do it. Before January 22nd, Kimsey sold a fur at Fort Klamath or Klamath Falls. So not looking good for this Kimsey guy.
No, he's got furs. He's going around selling to different fur buyers, right? Making money here and there.
Well, and especially the part about using a license in the name of Ed Nichols, a known murder victim.
We know the foxes were skinned out by the cabin. Like you said, he has that license. So, I mean, it's tying them together pretty good, I think.
Well, and the police thought so too. On April 25th, 1924, a $1,500 reward was announced for Kimsey's arrest and conviction. And you and I talk about rewards a lot. $1,500 in 1924, pretty good money.
Yeah.
We've done cases that were 5, 10 years ago where they were offering 3,000, 5,000.
Exactly what I was exactly thinking when we were researching this, that in today's time frame, we're not seeing a whole lot more.
In some instances. In
some, yes.
A coroner's jury determined that all three men died around January 15th, 1924. Ed Nichols was killed by a shotgun wound. Roy Wilson was killed by a bullet through the head and shot with a shotgun. Dewey Morris was killed by a blunt instrument and was shot with a shotgun. The county physician testified that they had been in the water for at least a month. H.D. Ennis testified that he and Clarence Adams went to the lake to fish when they saw the three bodies floating about 200 feet from the shore. Ed Logan testified that he found empty shotgun shells 12 feet from the cabin in two spots of bloody snow. Near the back of the cabin, there was a tooth. It was likely that Nichols was killed here since he was shot in the jaw. Clarence Adams testified that the shotgun and pistol shells corresponded with the 16-gauge gun found in the cabin and the 38 Luger that was missing, which belonged to Dewey Morris.
So it's all coming together.
Yeah, it's coming together. I don't know where the smoking gun is. Maybe that's a bad term to use in this case.
Yeah.
Charles Kimsey looks like a good suspect. And maybe when you add up everything, but I don't know that there's one thing. Maybe the driver's license. That license is kind of a big deal if that really happened. Yeah, I'm with you. It's coming together. On April 25th, 1924, the Bend Bulletin reported, the new theory is that two men entered the trapper's cabin, visited for a while, and then by some subterfuge, induced their host to step outside. When they stepped to the gun rack, took down a shotgun and revolver and opened fire. Again, with the writing, man, who uses the word subterfuge?
Every day, subterfuge.
There was a report that two men passed through Lava Lake in early winter and broke into a cabin 20 miles from Little Lava Lake. There was also a report of a man with a backpack and a gun visiting logging camps in January and asking for directions to Lava Lakes.
So we got some activity going on.
We do, but what is it telling us? My thought is you probably got a lot of people or a number of people, right? Traveling through in 1924, is someone with a backpack and a gun suspicious?
Probably not.
Probably not. Now, someone breaking into a cabin, that's suspicious. Two men specifically. But the Lava Lake murders case went cold after a few years. In 1928, Claude McCauley took over as sheriff. He ended up serving six terms, probably because of his eloquent writing skills.
I'm thinking exactly the same.
But what he did was he renewed the search for Charles Kimsey in January 1929, and it was said that he searched over 10,000 miles for Kimsey.
That's a big search.
That is a big search. According to the Deschutes Pioneers, Sheriff McCauley said, for the next 4 years, the hunt for Kimsey went on unceasingly. Every report was investigated, and sometimes Kimsey was reported seen in half a dozen places at once. That's hard to do.
It is, unless you have a lot of doppelgangers out there.
That's true. Gradually, the Lava Lake murder mystery was more or less forgotten by everyone except the officers of the law and friends of the murdered men. And sadly, that happens in many cases.
Yeah, I think people just kind of get back to their daily routines of life, and it slowly fades.
Yeah, even today, you know, we have some of these very high-profile cases, and there's a lot of mystery, intrigue, a lot of speculation, and a lot of people are into the cases.
Right.
But then eventually, if there's nothing else that comes out, there's no new revelations, the interest wanes, because there's so many other cases that are coming up every day.
Sadly, but it's true.
True Crime All the Time Unsolved is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to Gibby and I talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 27 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. On February 16, 1933, police in Kalispell, Montana, arrested a man named Bob Bales, who was said to have looked similar to Charles Kimsey. They thought they had the right man until they compared his ID, fingerprints, and photos to Charles Kimsey. But then on March 10th of that year, a jailer in Kalispell, Montana, saw Charles Kimsey, walked past him down the street. He ran to the courthouse and told an officer who arrested Kimsey downtown. And this time it turned out it really was Charles Kimsey. I mean, what are the odds?
Memorized those posters on the wall, I guess, back then, and said, ah, if I see that guy, I'm going to get him.
I get it, but you're talking about Kalispell, Montana.
Yeah.
You arrest a guy who looks like him, and then a month later, you actually arrest him.
How lucky is that?
That's very strange. Kimsey admitted his identity on March 11th. He said he knew nothing about Bob Bales or that the authorities had started up the search for him again. He claimed that he had been living in Columbia Falls. According to the Bend Bulletin, he also denied committing the Lava Lake murder, saying, they think I killed those trappers in Oregon, but I didn't. I was in Colorado working on the Moffett Tunnel at the time. But the thing is, the officers hadn't mentioned the murders, and they thought it was very suspicious that he brought it up himself.
Yeah, it's always suspicious when you bring up something that no one has asked you about. Is this, you're kind of putting a flashlight, a spotlight on yourself at that moment.
Yeah. Kind of like the Zodiac. I was watching the Zodiac movie the other day. Yeah. You know, I watch it all the time. And there's a scene in that movie where they go to interview Arthur Lee Allen at his workplace. And, you know, they're asking him some questions and he just keeps bringing up stuff. And at one point he says, oh, and about the blood that was in my car, I had killed some chickens. You know, he's like, he's trying to get ahead of them, but he's talking about stuff that they haven't even brought up.
So why even talk about it? Right,
exactly. It just makes you look bad. Kimsey waived extradition, so Sheriff McCauley and State Police Officer Sergeant Arthur Tuck went to pick him up in Kalispell. It's believed that Kimsey waived extradition because he preferred to face his charges in Oregon versus the charges against him in other states. And we mentioned it, right? He was wanted for murder in a number of different states and a bunch of other crimes. Sheriff McCauley and Sergeant Tuck left to bring Kimsey back to Oregon. They hoped to get him to talk on the drive home. And that makes some sense. They were going to have some time.
Yeah, it's not a short drive, so why not shoot away some questions and see if you get him to confess?
Well, it's not a short drive, but it would have been even longer in what, the 1920s?
Oh, for sure.
1930s, yeah. We're up to? According to the Deschutes Pioneers, Sergeant Tuck tried to talk to Kimsey, but he said, you can ask all the questions you want about that Lava Lake case, but I won't answer a damn one of them. Tuck agreed with Kimsey's alibi. He told the Bend Bulletin in 1953, the evidence against him was too thin. Kimsey's story that he was employed in the Moffett Tunnel when the murder occurred is airtight. So I'm assuming they must have checked that out. Obviously, to say it's airtight,
right.
He's not just believing his word on that.
So it's got to be disappointing.
Had to be very disappointing because he looked like such a good suspect. Kimsey was transferred to Oregon on March 16th, 1933 and placed in the Deschutes County Jail. Sheriff McCauley returned to Bend to work on the case against Kimsey, but his witnesses weren't cooperative. At this point, Kimsey was 48 years old. And people who remembered him thought he had aged considerably. Sheriff McCauley and investigators spent weeks gathering evidence to prove that Kimsey committed the murders, But Officer W.C. Bender and Carl Schumacher could not make a positive identification. Bender had said he would never forget Kimsey's face. But now he said that too much time had passed and the man in the lineup was too old for him to make a positive identification.
Isn't that funny that 48 is somebody really old back then?
He was too old.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but how much time had really passed? 9, 10 years?
Yeah.
I get it. That's some time. But to say that it's been so much time, he doesn't even look like himself. I don't know. That seems a little strange to me. Now, Carl Schumacher said he probably could identify Kimsey, but he didn't want to risk a man's life if he wasn't absolutely certain. And that I completely understand.
Sure, yeah.
Because I think that holds true still today. And if you're looking through a photo lineup, if you're not absolutely certain that you've got the right person, you shouldn't be picking anybody.
No, because this is somebody's life you're talking about.
The grand jury looked over the Lava Lake case on April 10th, 1933. Utah wanted Kimsey for a murder case. Idaho wanted him for escape. Sheriff McCauley wanted to keep Kimsey in Oregon. So he had him indicted for the assault and robbery of W.E. Harrison back in 1923. McCauley reached out to Harrison to testify against Kimsey. Kimsey was charged with assault and robbery while armed with a dangerous weapon, but he pleaded not guilty. His trial began on April 20th, 1933. Kimsey's defense was careful to question the potential jurors about how they felt about Kimsey and how their attitude might be affected by the Lava Lake case. Most of the jurors knew little about the assault charge. W.E. Harrison came from California to Oregon to testify. The Bend Bulletin reported, witnesses of the police lineup say that Kimsey reacted to Harrison as though he had seen a ghost.
He probably didn't think he was alive. Remember, he put him in that well thinking he was going to be dead.
And Harrison identified Charles Kimsey as the man who tried to kill him. Kimsey was found guilty after just 3 hours of deliberation. And on April 25th, Charles Kimsey was sentenced to life in prison for assault and robbery and being armed with a dangerous weapon. He was transferred to the Oregon State Penitentiary on April 26th.
I mean, life in prison for attempted murder.
I'm down.
Yeah, same here. I think later, you know, we've had cases much later than this that pretty light.
Well, and it seems as though that's what we've seen, right? When you go back in time quite a ways, there was some pretty tough sentencing. And then there was a period of time there where the sentences were lighter. And now we've gone back to tougher sentencing, it seems like. In August 1945, Charles Kimsey escaped from what was called a gun gang at the state prison, but he was eventually caught. At the time of an August 1961 Bend Bulletin publication, he was alive and still incarcerated at the Oregon State Pen. However, according to a 2019 article from the Tillamook Headlight Herald, Kimsey appealed and argued that his sentence was disproportionate. In 1957, he was paroled and moved to Idaho.
You know, if that's true, I can see where they probably made a case for why do I get life in prison based on the crime that I committed. I liked life in prison, but you can see where they could make a case for it.
Well, obviously they did, and somebody bought it because he got paroled. Now, he did 24 years.
Yeah.
So you can argue, was that correct? Was that not correct? Because even life in prison, you're going to go up for parole.
Sure.
So.
And then you wonder, maybe they didn't have the notification process to let the other states know that wanted him, that, hey, he's coming out. If you want him, come and get him.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they didn't have quite the communication system back then. But the Lava Lake murders case remains unsolved to this day. Kimsey was really the only official suspect, but there were some theories that there were two killers. According to an article from the Headlight Herald, Carl Schumacher remembered two men. He said one had been quiet and introverted, the other talkative and friendly. The friendly one had chatted about trapping, the wilderness, Bend, and various other things, clearly trying to charm him. The other had looked a lot like Kimsey, but looking at the mugshot, he just couldn't be sure. The man he'd seen had dropped the furs and left, saying nothing and doing nothing to call attention to himself. And I do think that Carl Schumacher, you know, a pretty integral piece to this puzzle. Right? He was the one that it's believed Kimsey sold the furs to using an ID that said Ed Nichols. To me, that was really one of the biggest pieces in the puzzle against Charles Kimsey.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, it tied him into the case.
But remember, Schumacher was the one that said he didn't want to risk a man's life by identifying him if he wasn't absolutely certain. The Headlight Herald wrote, "The question remains, though, who was Kimsey's accomplice? Who was the glib, smooth-talking man who chatted up Schumacher while negotiating the sale of the stolen fox pelts? Who was the unknown social engineer who somehow lured Nichols, Morris, and Wilson out of their log cabin, almost completely unarmed, so that Kimsey could wreak his vengeance upon them?" Remember, they knew who Kimsey was, and they were expecting trouble from him. They were not expecting trouble from whoever knocked on their cabin door that fateful day. And except for Wilson with his Luger, they left their weapons in the cabin when they followed him out, which strongly argues that they didn't know trouble was afoot until they were standing in the open and lead was in the air.
That makes good sense, right? It was somebody they trusted, somebody they felt comfortable enough with or didn't feel any threat.
Yeah, I don't even know if they trusted. They could not have even known this person.
Yeah.
I think the key is it wasn't someone who they were threatened by.
Right.
Somebody, whether they knew them or not.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
The Headlight Herald also reported that Melanie Tupper wrote a 2013 book titled The Trapper Murders and said that Kimsey had an accomplice. According to Melanie, the accomplice was a man named Ray Van Buren Jackson. Somebody's parents liked presidents.
Yes, they did.
This guy was called the Angel of Death of Central Oregon. That's a hell of a nickname.
That is a, yeah. He's supposed to be a very bad individual.
Jackson was a known associate of Kimsey. He's associated with several unsolved cases and suspicious deaths in Oregon in the early 1900s, such as John Creed Kahn, Ethel Martin, Julius Walinde, Emma Dobkins, Harold Bradley, and Ira Bradley. He was a Silver Lake school teacher, turned thief and embezzler to forgeries and killings. Jackson died of suicide in February of 1938 at the age of 68. He shot himself in the chest with a shotgun, according to Melanie Tupper. Man, school teacher to thief to embezzler to forger to killer.
A pretty bad individual.
And a pretty strange trip.
It really is.
To get there.
Yeah.
Almost 100 years later, the Lava Lake murders remain unsolved. I don't see how there's any possibility, Gibbs, that anyone connected with this case could be alive today. There's just no way.
No.
And that obviously makes things harder to solve. You know, when every single person who could possibly be connected to a case is dead, things get pretty tough.
Yeah, it's going to have to be one of those things that, you know, before Grandpa passed, he told me the story about him and another guy
doing this, this, and this.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be some kind of national treasure thing where, you know, they find some kind of relic up in the attic and that points to, you know, some conclusive something or other. But it is a very interesting story. You know, I like some of these that go back to like the 1920s and, you know, seeing how the police worked and how investigations worked. And, you know, obviously they didn't have technology, the technology that we have today.
Right.
Somehow they did have rental cars, which still kind of blows me away.
It does.
I'm still fascinated by that. But you can see that they did some of the same things that still happen today.
Yeah.
You know, just without the use of technology, they're running down leads. They're, you know, traversing states to try to find people.
Yeah.
And so that part, you know, is of interest to me.
Good old definitely. Detective skills.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of them remain pretty similar today. But that's it for our episode on the Lava Lake murders. We got some voicemails, Gibbs. You want to check those out?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. This is myself calling from Tacoma, Washington. I was just listening to the Unsolved Nancy and Joey Botticcio. And about the first crime, Randy, you guys are saying, you know, he didn't take any of her jewelry, only like her CDs or sneakers. What I'm thinking is because if you take jewelry, expensive jewelry, to a pawn shop, they're definitely going to raise some brows and, you know, want to know where you got it from or how you had it. But if you're taking sneakers and CDs, no one's even going to bat an eyelash on that. Anyways, Mike, I hope you feel better. Stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
All right. Thanks for the insight. I like it. I do feel better. And I agree, right? You can raise some suspicion taking a Cartier watch to a pawn shop.
Yeah.
Possibly.
That's why you got to have a good fence.
But there's the flip side of it.
Yeah.
If you're running in certain circles, do you not know somebody who's willing to buy a Cartier watch for, I don't want to say pennies on the dollar, but for a lot less than it's worth? You're still going to get a bunch of money out of it. You're just selling it to someone who's not legitimate.
Yeah. If they want it, knowing that if it came off of a person that was murdered, well, you have to not tell them that, you know?
Well, they may not even care.
That's true.
Depending on how illegitimate they are, they're just like, okay. Yeah.
Give me that watch.
I'm getting a Cartier watch for $400 or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. My name is Zoe. I've been listening to you guys since 2018. And just this week, I signed up for the Patreon because it was Halloween and I needed some more creepiness in my life. And I just laughed because as soon as I signed up, it said, I signed up on Halloween and it said, this will be renewed November 1st. So that cracked me up. You guys got an extra $2 out of me, but I recommend to everyone to get onto the Patreon. It's great, more content, and get to know Mike and Gibby a little bit better. And yeah, I can't wait to hear you guys try and say my name. So thanks again for making great content and keep your own time ticking.
Well, thank you so much for supporting us. And it is something good to point out. Patreon charges at the first of every month.
Right.
So always sign up at the first of the month. Because if you sign up on the last day of the month, they're going to charge you and then they're going to turn around and charge you again.
We got you, didn't we?
It's just how it works. But we appreciate it very much.
Hey, guys, this is Betty from Central Oregon. I'm just calling to say I heard the call for more Twizzlers. So I jumped on Amazon, send you guys 5 pounds. Hopefully I did it right and you guys get it. Have a great day. Love hearing you. And keep your own time ticking.
So I'm so glad that we got this voicemail because we got the Twizzlers in the mail. Gibby's actually eating one right now.
Yeah, they're right here.
But there was no note with it.
No.
And so I didn't talk about it on TCAT because I didn't know who it was from. And now we know.
I think there's 4 pounds.
4 pounds. Probably you've eaten a pound since you've been here.
Yeah. It's not hard to do.
It's very easy for you. And Gibby appreciates it very much. All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
For Halloween with Pluto TV's 31 Nights of Horror. All month long, Pluto TV is bringing you the best Halloween movies, shows, and more. Watch classic horror movies like The Grudge or The Blair Witch Project, or scream along with your favorite stars like Ryan Reynolds in Life. Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows. The best part, it's so free, it's chilling. No credit card, no sign up, no fee. Download the Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start screaming now.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person, too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.